No, hi, and welcome once again to the Threefold Lotus Kloon online. Tonight we're going to tackle the subject of anatman and impermanence. They really kind of go hand in hand. Anatman is a subject in Buddhism that isn't often talked about, simply because it's one of those things in Buddhism that once you understand the fundamentals of Buddhism, it's just not really a question. But I realize for a lot of people, especially beginners, and a lot of people, surprisingly enough, have been practicing a long time. And this happens a lot in Hinayana and Tripitaka Buddhists who aren't well versed in the ultimate teachings of Shakyamuni during the last 8 years of his life when he expounded the highest form of Mahayana teachings. And there are schools that say they incorporate Mahayana teachings into their sects, but they don't fully embrace them. And that's unfortunate because they really are misleading a lot of people. They don't really get it. And it comes up a lot. I'm located in the northeast of Mississippi right now. And most people will tell you I'm right in the middle of the Bible Belt. So the subject of an eternal soul comes up much more often than it should, but or well, let's not even talk in those terms. So I thought while I'm talking on this primary fundamental core Buddhist thinking that we've been working on for the last two videos, and now I'm going to start to move from the conceptual into real world understanding of what that means. What are the implications of this space that we've been talking about, this non-noumena, this non-space? I thought of a couple of quick analogies that might help as well. And I want to make reference to something that has been talked about a lot in the last few decades, in scientific, cosmological, astronomy, and mathematics, is this idea of string theory. You've probably learned about it if you're not familiar with it. A quick search on Google will give you the basics without getting it into mired in it all the mathematics. The highest advancement of that string theory to date is M theory. Which posits brains, BRANES, not brains like we have in our head, short for membranes, and all that's going to make sense in a moment. These mathematical theories of reality and the ultimate truth of all thingness phenomena posits many more dimensions than we experience here in our human tendencies and conditions. We experience vertical, horizontal, and depth, three dimensions. And because there are three dimensions, we experience time. We loosely call that the fourth dimension, but it's really a function of the space. Space-time is the same thing. Anyway, without getting into those particulars, for our purposes of our discussion, it's been posited that there are possibly nine dimensions that we are living in right now, and possibly all the way to 11 dimensions. Those other dimensions are so subtle, so discrete, that we don't have the facility to experience them. They're happening all around us, just like dark matter and dark energy are there. We just don't know how to know them, how to experience them with our tools, our vision consciousness, our hearing consciousness, our smell consciousness, our touch consciousness. We don't know. We don't feel. It's just like, you remember the old, the science teacher would tell you, that this table feels solid, but actually it's made up of a heck of a lot more space than it is actual material, atoms, molecules, and so forth. It's kind of a brain twister, and it's where all that science fiction comes from, where you see these people putting their arms through walls and things that somehow they can negotiate that empty space. I'm sorry, I got a little moth or something flying around here. Not losing it, not yet. So, remember we've been talking about this quiescent energy, this Amala consciousness, this Wuji, a point of origin that isn't a place, but a location. It's a bit of a mind twister. But what's interesting is that, and this is why I brought up string theory and M theory in particular, there's a theory that these energies, these vast fields of energy, are like huge sheets. I mean, vast, vast, unknowable sheets. That are just lumbering around like an example on Earth would be come on, a glacier. A glacier, we learned in recent times really that it's a huge ice sheet that is lumbering along. It's always moving, but the movement is so subtle and so minute to our senses that we don't perceive it. However, if you've ever been on a glacier or near one, it sounds incredible because there's always movement going on. There's always something changing. Okay. So I think the glacier kind of works for just an analogy for us to be able to talk about this so that we can kind of picture it in our minds. Believe me, all the words I could manufacture wouldn't come close to describing this vast thing of energy. Now, in M theory, the thought is that as these vast sheets of quiescent energy move around, they sometimes bump into one another. And if you can imagine like one of these huge oil tankers, or let's get back to the glacier. If a glacier was coming into contact with another glacier, the serious implications of that crushing and movement and all of this, even though it's incredibly slow, it's like tectonic plates, the way the Alps were born, if you know anything about the crust of the earth and how the plates of the earth are moving against each other, and one will go under the other, and this will be a whole ridge of mountains that's created. And it's just fascinating when you study the way everything in the universe works. It's just the phenomenal sources of energy that come from the very slow but vast, huge, immense processes. Well, it's one thing for a glacier to run into another glacier and create what M theory proposes is a big bang, where the pressures and the energy is so great that it just blows up into what we call a universe, into that vast dark energy and creating dark matter and dark gravity and so on. But if we stick to a simpler example, like the glacier itself is making noise. Why? Because certain areas of the glacier are getting hit by the sun. And that condition for this, that you could say, in other words, you could say the glacier is like quiescent water, the same way that Wuji or the Amala consciousness is quiescent energy. Follow? So you could take a little teaspoon of that glacier in one spot and another teaspoon in another spot, and you could say they're both teaspoons of glacier and they'd be identical. But if you finally got down into a microscope and subparticles and so forth, there's always going to be a difference. No matter where those teaspoons come from all over the glacier, they're all going to be a little bit different. Okay? But the conditions they find themselves in, those little particles or those little whatevers of that portion of that glacier, if it's on the bottom, it's under a great deal of pressure and it's in the dark. If it's on the side, it's being crushed against rock and pushed into other pieces of the glacier and under great pressure. And on top, it's going to have no weight on it, but it's going to have heat of a different sort, radiation that's going to be a different condition. Those things. What I want to point out is the glacier in all of its component parts and places is basically the same thing, but all under different conditions. So the actions and reactions that happen to those little particles of the glacier, depending on where they are in the glacier, are actually going to produce different results. Make sense? The sun on the top may actually melt it enough to make it run water and melt. The pressure on the sides may create instant sparks of heat that will quick freeze and make even harder ice in those parts. So the same particles of ice of the glacier, depending on the conditions they find themselves in, will behave and create matter of a different sort. Make sense? It's a crude analogy, but if you can picture Wu Ji, the amount of consciousness and the quiescent energy that everything is made from, because all matter is energy, we've already discussed, then it becomes, in that vastness of that energy, it becomes understandable why there are so many different phenomena, from rocks to blades of grass to universes to you and me, or fish. So I tried to make a little sketch of this, and I have a little cloud at the top. That's our quiescent energy and subtle shifting known as the Amala consciousness. But it's not a cloud. It's just that, again, words and drawings. How do we make sense of that? So what happens is these causal chains, and if I'm losing you with any of these terms, go back and review tapes 1 and 2. I don't want to continue to repeat myself because you won't want to listen to me anymore. These causal chains, they mostly, most of them in this energy, they're always going on, but they arise and then they fall away. They fall right back into the quiescent energy. They have, you might say, a very short lifespan. Because the stuff in the center of glacier is largely in the same condition all the time. The whole thing's moving, so there is interaction, but the interactions are so minute, so subtle, that they might produce a little bit and then they ebb away. Sometimes they may collectively, in a whole area, start to shift with enough pressure that there's a tear, kind of like an earthquake happens. And so there's a violent release of energy, a lot of stuff happens, and then rest again. So it doesn't matter necessarily that the chain reaction is brief, short, or minute, or subtle. It matters the conditions it's in and the arrival of other conditions with other energies, with their tendencies combining to put together a set of complicated reactions that create a specific kind of matter with a certain intention. This to me, this is the hardest part to grasp. But I think if you understand it in super subtle terms, if you've ever played billiards, pool, and you hit the cue ball. The cue ball now is in motion. It runs into another ball and it transfers a lot of that energy to the other ball. The cue ball may continue to roll some or not, or may even spin backwards, depending on its tendencies and the conditions of how it struck the other ball. You follow? Now, that other ball has a lot of what the cue ball transferred to it. And it may run into nothing at all until it dies and bounces around on the pads of the sides, or it may run into another ball or a whole slew of balls, where those balls will all get certain portions of that energy and they will all do what they can do with it until they run out of that impetus. This is a chain reaction. This is a great illustration of a chain reaction. What we never really think about in our human instantiation, in our human consciousness, is that when these balls are hitting each other, yes, there's a transfer of energy. And if that transfer of energy is of such a pattern, it will transfer a very similar energy to the next ball. In Buddhism, that's the seed, the minute vestiges of an intention. See, I remember I talked about Buddhist consciousnesses. So how do consciousnesses arise? They arise from these chain reactions and the accumulation of intent of the reactions, not intent like you and I have, not willpower like you and I have. That's extremely complex. But that complexity comes from an original point. And that original point is a super, super simple version of volition. There is a will to move. In physics, you would call it applied force. Something tends to not move until a force is applied. Once the force is applied, then there's movement. Okay? In Asia, that's chi. I'm calling it energy. Okay? And taiji is a volitional force, a motivation, something, a will, a force that puts into motion. And that evolves. If you put 100 billion billion of those little wills to move and intents of force to motivate something to move, you have altogether a volitional consciousness. Is it starting to make sense? We're talking from the extremely minute to the vast and infinite. Buddhism is from each end and everything in between. Okay, so occasionally a chain reaction arises in conditions plentiful of other actions and include many into the growing chain reaction to form properties and an ever stronger will to manifest being in order to manipulate energies into matter and into the nidana of name and form or differentiation. All of this is going on before there's anything at all. All of this is happening in a micro instant, nano instant, nano, 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 nano instant. Okay? All of these billions upon billions of reactions in order to create a moving force with some intent. Because intent, whether the ball knows it or not on the pool table, the intent is to get into the corner pocket. Okay, but the idea of the ball rolling into that polar pocket is a dream until it actually happens. This is the nidana. This is the 12-linked chain of causation. So before you get to the fourth level of the nidana, where you were talking about differentiation, that name and form, nothing can have a name. You can't name something until it has a form. Until it has a form, something can't be named. Like I just said, you can't go into the corner pocket until you've been in the corner pocket. Then you could say the ball is in the corner pocket. Until then, that's a dream. It doesn't exist. It's only a will. Follow? So we haven't even gone down the 12 steps of the chain yet. We're only in that instant moment of a bunch of reactions coming together to create a tendency, a large tendency with a commitment, and we're still at that point just energies with a commitment to make something that will exist. We are human beings, but there are rock beings, tree beings. There are all things that are being. You see how Buddhism doesn't work in the static, because life and everything in it is made up of discrete moments in a chain. Did you hear that? If you're not sure what I'm talking about there, go to my other videos on birth and death, or birth and rebirth. I'll talk a lot about how life is a series of points. Remember, locations that don't exist are just locations. You put enough of them together, you learn this in geometry, you make a line. That's how we perceive life, in a linear way, like a line. But in truth, life for everything, flowers, you and me, planets, they're a series of discrete moments that hand off between each moment, just like a cue ball hands off its energy to the next cue ball. Our life is like that. Untold billions of moments strung together. This is why we age. This is why we don't always look the same. If we were truly linear, if we were just what we think we are, we would just be that. But we transfer moment to 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 moment, all of this information. And we perceive it as time, number one, in space, number two, really the same. And we think of ourselves as a lifetime, birth and death being our focal points of that lifetime. Birth is nothing more than the instantiation of all of these billions and billions of processes of chain reactions that have come to manifest it, and the manifestation of it, and the growing and the old age, sickness and death is just the tendencies and conditions of this portion of that chain reaction. And when we die, that chain reaction just disintegrates and fades slowly back into that quiescent energy. We arise, we fall away, just like everything in the universe. It's not entropy, it's not nihilism, it's just the process of life. Okay, so I'm reading my notes here because I wanted to make sure that I followed a certain pattern and that I made sense for you, because I know that's a lot of information. Billions and billions of these chain reactions had to combine in order to manifest a universe where a single molecule of DNA could evolve to become a human being. Let me read that again and really think about this in terms of what we've been talking about for the last two videos. Billions upon billions of these chain reactions had to combine, work together, in order to manifest, go from energy through the Dadana, everything goes through the causal chain, to become a universe, first of all, millions of years of universe that we've so far experienced, in order to be able to manifest the atoms, particles, and molecules necessary to make something called a molecule, and many different zillions of different types of molecules, but specifically the molecule that is called DNA, it holds over 4 billion genes. Is it 4 billion or 4 million? An astronomical amount of genes in one molecule, structured to evolve from single cell organisms all the way to a human being, a self-perceiving entity. In other words, the first motivational thought that was put together out of a group of chain reactions had at its base tendencies and desires and motivations a searching and a wanting and an attraction toward being a self-perceiving being. And in order to get there, it had to interact with in order to make an eyeball, you can't just pop an eyeball into space. It has to be held in something in order so that you can have vision. What is vision? You have to have stuff to see. You have to have something that can perceive it. Okay? If that's the way you assemble a human body, then you have to come to terms with making all of the things that a human body is made of and that a human being needs in its environment in order to perceive itself. That's mind-boggling, right? But that's the process of life, our process. Now, if we understand that, then it makes sense that with these vast fields of energy, there must be countless other universes. What they manifest is anybody's guess. We know that what our universe, yours universe, and my universe, because they are separate, had at its fundamental goal to create what it is that we are, self-perceiving beings. But not all chain reactions want that. Some chain reactions just want to get in the corner pocket. Okay? So we could fantasize about that all we want, and that's what science fiction is for. But in Buddhism, we're concerned with life, sickness, old age, and death. The Buddha wanted to answer, how do I liberate humans from suffering? And if I understand how this life process works to the nth degree, then I should know. So that's what we're talking about. At the beginning of all these chain reactions is the quiescent energy. That's the fount of all things. Therefore, that quiescent energy has the knowledge of all possibilities it can manifest. This is the enlightened mind, or the Amala consciousness. We've gone through this, but I'm adding another dimension to it now. If you are, here we go with language. If you can imagine a knowing that comes from this vast wuji, this amala consciousness, this quiescent energy, then nothing would surprise you. Nothing would be new. Nothing would be unknowable, because you would have the repository of everything potential in you already. It just would be there. We have a direct line. Because we're from there, we have that component, Amala consciousness, within us now. This is the great teaching of the Lotus Sutra, that you don't have to be reborn over millennia and all of these, you know, mystical things in order to attain enlightenment. You already are. It's already a component of everything here. This is what we talk about when we talk about oneness. We all have this Amala consciousness, this quiescent energy. It's part of everything that we are. Remember all the space in the table? It's quiescent energy. There is enlightenment there. Now, here's the key part of what I want to talk about today. And this won't take much longer, because I just really want you to get that idea of that quiescent energy. The billions of subsequent reactions that join the chain that manifested each of us, as we just discussed, all of those various chains that combined, each of those chains had a tendency of its own, and with the conditions of other chains, was manipulated into this larger and larger chain until it gets to universe, precipitates planets, precipitates us. There's incalculable amounts of those Nidana chains that combine into a larger and larger chain in order to then provide for human life. What I want to tell you now is, if you can envision this in your mind, you're a Mala consciousness, your ninth consciousness that knows everything, that is unperturbable. It's like a small jewel within us. I'm giving you a visual. And it is surrounded by all of these other consciousnesses that we like to call the monkey mind. So picture these billions and billions of other chain reactions as embodied in little mental monkeys whose sole purpose is to get you to pay attention to them. All the monkey wants is to me, 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 me. I'm being, I'm being, I'm being. Now, we needed that kind of insane energy to want to be in order to create a universe to then precipitate DNA that would create a self-perceiving being. We needed them, but once we're born and manifest as humans, we don't need them anymore. They're in the way. In fact, that is the source of suffering. Because all of those little monkeys' desires to be are obfuscating our human mind, which is, I have to check, but it's the sixth or seventh consciousness. The human mind's existence has to wrestle constantly with these billions of monkeys around it in order to clear a path to that ninth consciousness and quiesce and stop the noise, stop the want, stop. All life, Buddha said, is suffering. Why? Because all life is born of these incredible desires to be. And to satiate all those desires all the time is nearly impossible. The function of the human mind, then, is to calm monkeys down one at a time. Calm them down, appease them. Give them a can. Here, go take a nap. All those monkeys are what Buddhism calls our ego. Our ego is delicate because it's fragile little monkeys who at any time can feel threatened or can feel excited. This is why Buddhism is often called the middle way, because the monkeys overreact in polar directions all over the place, from very hot anger to very cold distance to depression to happiness to just craziness. But reality, the quiescent knowledge of life and the beauty of perceiving it, which is the unique opportunity of this human existence, is so awesome beyond comprehension, it doesn't require all of these volatile emotions, because it just is. Does this make sense? So, this accumulate of monkeys is known as Ichinin Sanzen, or the Alaya consciousness. That's the eighth consciousness. And for about 50 years of Buddha's teachings, he dealt with that as the highest consciousness that could be known or reached. It was thought, because he was dealing with people who couldn't possibly understand what we understand today, because of our evolution, before our capacity to understand through science and the myriad ways we have of learning the world around us, our perception, whether we work on it or not, as we evolve as human beings, is expanding and growing in capability, whether we want it or not. And we have finally reached a point as a species that we can understand that there's a consciousness that lies, that is even more fundamental than the Alaya consciousness, where all of this causation and these causal chains and the monkeys exist. We're not just ego. There's something beyond ego, which is beautiful, quiescent, solid, unperturbed, indestructible happiness, I've heard it called. Happiness has so much charisma about it, though I'm hesitant to use that. But, you know, you should know. So this is Ichinen Sanzen. Ichinen Sanzen, why? Because karmically, we as human beings make causes. And the causes have effects built into them immediately, right? We understand that. But the causes that came together to bring about a situation where we could be born as human are so, the causational changes, as I've said before, are so subtle and accumulate so quickly that we're a product of, yes, volitional karma, but karma before we were born. And so we represent karmically, and when we're born, the minute we're born, as a package of this causal chain full of its own tendencies and conditions. And as the human mind becomes more aware of those conditions, we struggle to manipulate those conditions, whether we're born white or black, poor or rich, or so on and so forth, with blue eyes or, you know, whatever, all of those things we negotiate as we grow through our human perceptive life. And Buddhism is a way for, no matter what form you've taken as a human, to be able to increase your perceptive abilities, to be able to get past, to go right past those formative karmic building blocks, and to create causes to, again, appease the monkey, appease the Alaya consciousness, quiet our ego, and then be able to see much more clearly through the Alaya consciousness into the quiescent energy, our innate, our core Buddha nature, where everything is calm, quiescent, awesome. That's when we're liberated from the sufferings that attend the Alaya consciousness. Does that make sense? That's a biggie. That is Ichinen Sanzen. And all of it occurs over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. 3,000 variations in each single moment of life. 3,000 realms in a single moment of life. Ichinen Sanzen. Transferred to the next moment, to the next moment, to the next moment. Why 3,000 variations? Those are the myriad Buddhist descriptions for the possibilities that you might, with your volition, your human mind, push your causal chain in. So you can change karma. This is a radical thought. This is Mahayana Buddhism. Before Mahayana, karma was immutable. You couldn't change it. It was an impossibility to change. With Mahayana Buddhism, we now understand with Mahayana that the causes that we make with our conscious human mind, and this is the beauty of the self-perception, with greater perception, we can make decisions that move our karmic freight train every little bit toward appeasing the Alaya consciousness and looking more directly at a quiescent, benevolent, wonderful state of being, free of suffering. Now, we can get into almost anything else from here, because if you really get this, I'm convinced, If you really get and understand how life begins and just reverse the process for the way it quiesces and goes back and dies, then you understand the core concept of impermanence that Buddha kept talking about. Nothing has in and of itself an identity. Everything arises and falls away. Nothing is eternal. Nothing is permanent. No thing, no phenomena is permanent, because it all arises from noumena and returns to noumena. Quiescence. So the idea of some sort of spiritual container of Sylvain or Bob or Janet that leaves the body and goes elsewhere and then comes back either as Janet or as some other thing is absolute nonsense. This is why it's not really discussed. Nagarjuna, in I think 401 AD, wrote the Madhyamika, and you might want to look that up. But if you can read the Madhyamika, he has a whole section of it called Anatman, where he uses the argumentation debate form of using every possible approach to a question that you could possibly manifest, not only in thinking, but in language, so that he can just destroy the idea that there's a permanent, eternal thing, anything. And he focused it on Atman, the soul. He said that you cannot be a Buddhist and you do not understand the Buddhist teachings if you do not get that there cannot be an eternal soul. It just flies in the face of everything that Buddhism has as its fundamental concept. We all arise from quiescent energy, and we all go back to quiescent energy, but that doesn't mean we're the same. Remember the teaspoon I was talking about? The ocean on the planet is vast, but if I take a teaspoon out of the Pacific and a teaspoon out of the Indian and a teaspoon out of the Atlantic, you could say they're all ocean water. But on many, many levels, even to the naked eye, you'll be able to see differences. And then if I take that Indian teaspoon and I dump it in the Pacific, which is essentially, you know, what happens when you instantiate and then quiesce, how am I going to find that teaspoon of Indian Ocean in the Pacific anytime later? It just makes no sense, you see? So the idea of a soul or reincarnation, it's laughable. Buddhism doesn't spend a lot of time talking about it. I've had to talk about it a whole lot more because of where I am and because of the capacity of people here. But again, if you get what we've been talking about for now the third video, you can see how nothing has its own nature. Everything manifests as an experience and then fades away. Arises, fades away, arises, fades away. What's another name for arising and fading away? And I'm going to leave you with this because I know this is getting long. Arising, birth, falling away, death. And the moment to moment to moment of that, the distance in between, each moment is a birth, and the next is a rebirth. The energy transferred to another point, with albeit some variations, 3,000 realms in a single moment of life. Every moment of life, 3,000 distinct hedonic chains have been put into action that modify the previous moment. Maybe a little, maybe a lot. Depends on how your DNA is programmed, which, how was it programmed? By infinite hedonic chains coming together to make the DNA that makes you and your monkeys and your mala consciousness and your lion consciousness, your mono consciousness, your touch, smell, hearing, vision, all of it. I know this, I've been studying this for close to 30 years, so to me, I really get it in here, but it's taken me 3 long videos to try to explain it, and words are just very unsatisfactory. But I hope I'm giving you an idea. And I'm going to assume you're getting it with me because I don't want to continue going over the same material. But believe me, it will keep coming up. You will, the more you study in Buddhism, the more you'll, oh, that's like that. It's the same discussion in a different way. So if I've said something that's just made your head fall off or I've contradicted myself, I don't know, please make a comment under the video. Let me know so that I can address it, so that I can help me and you become better Buddhists. In the meantime, enjoy your life. If you have to suffer, put a time limit on it. You know, I had somebody tell me a long time ago, you know, if you're going to feel depressed, okay, be depressed. But look at the clock and give yourself an hour to be depressed. At the end of that hour, stop being depressed. It sounds silly, but just the idea that you're watching the clock and that you need to change it actually helps you change it. It's about making causes to be life-affirming rather than letting the monkeys control you. Let your mind control the monkeys, not the other way around. Okay? With that, let's close. Thank you so much for participating. See you again real soon. I'm not sure what I'll talk about next, but I'm sure I'll have something to say. For now, this is Sivu Sylvain signing out. Nam Myo Ho Renge Kyo Nam Myo Ho Renge Kyo Nam Myo Ho Renge Kyo Nam.